You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
The stories that have made headlines are horrifying.
Toronto paramedics tell City News a 9-year-old boy has serious injuries, what Toronto police call life-altering injuries, after a dog attack near the playground. Investigators are now searching for a woman they said fled the scene with the dog following the incident.
An 11-year-old boy is dead following a dog attack here in South Edmonton. Police say they arrived on scene Monday to find the boy severely injured by two large dogs.
Those are individual incidents. Anecdotal evidence, as somebody trying to discredit fears of a rise in dog attacks might claim. Are the numbers really up? Well, I don't have data for all of Canada. It doesn't exist. But here's just a limited slice of research and what it will tell you. The following Canadian cities, reported either through raw numbers or declarative statements from police and animal control, a large increase in the number of dog attacks or vicious animal incidents. Are you ready? Toronto and Edmonton, where the two stories you just heard come from, have both sounded alarm bells. So have Ottawa and Windsor and Montreal and Sudbury and others. And lest you think this was a Canadian problem, the United Kingdom and Wales reported a large national surge of dog attacks in 2022. So the numbers show it's happening. But why? Is it the pandemic puppies, which is where a lot of armchair speculation tends to land? Or is it something else? More importantly, what are we doing about it? What works and what doesn't work here? And are we prepared to actually enforce the measures that will? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Dr. Tim Arthur is a veterinarian as well as the Canadian Veterinary Medical Association's president-elect. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you this morning?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for finding a little bit of time for us.
Well, a subject near and dear to my heart and happy to sort of spread as much information as I can for your listeners.
You know, I listed some cities off the top in the intro. I also played a couple of clips that you don't need to hear because I'm sure you're familiar with the recent attacks in Toronto and in Edmonton. As a veterinarian, as somebody who speaks to a ton of them, have you noticed an increase in dog attacks overall? Is this something you and other vets talk about?
In my day-to-day life as a veterinarian, this isn't a subject that has come up with increasing frequency. As a member of the general public who has access to the internet, to the newspapers, yeah, I think we're all aware that either these numbers are increasing or we are going through just a horrible blip. I saw some notes out of Toronto that they seem to have an increase in incidences, and I know locally in Ottawa we're seeing it as well. So I'm assuming it is a Canadian phenomenon as opposed to us in Ontario just seem to be doing something terribly wrong.
Yeah, it's a Canadian phenomenon, includes Montreal, Sudbury, Windsor, Edmonton, even before this latest tragic attack, had already sounded alarm bells over the increase in number of attacks. And lest you think it's a Canadian problem, the United Kingdom and Wales as well reported a massive increase in 2022. So this is clearly something that's going on. And I guess my question for you as a vet who sees these animals and deals with them all the time, when you think about it, what are the possible causes of an increase in attacks like this?
What's causing the current increase? I'm not sure there's any hard and fast research on that. But we do know, you know, when we study these incidents, there are a number of factors that pop up more often than you would expect them to. And certainly we know that a lot of these attacks will involve either children or senior citizens. We know most of the time the dogs are not really under control or under direct supervision. We know that interactions such as running, chasing, playing often seem to be involved in initiating some of these attacks. We also know that the inability of some members of the public to actually read a dog's body language, body positions are involved. As a veterinarian, I'll regularly deal with clients that are telling me what their dog has done and why it's done it. And when I actually question and listen, they're not interpreting things correctly. Obviously, the physical size of the dog has an awful lot to do with this. That dog's training, its previous interactions with people, and, you know, specifically the people who raised it when it was young, all those things have an awful lot to do with it, as does population density. The more people, the more dogs. This is much more of an urban than a rural issue. And then maybe not the level of reporting, enforcement, the local legislation, just like how seriously is the area where these dogs are living taking this problem. All those things seem to circle around, okay, maybe that's why it's happened, but I don't think it really addresses why does it seem to be increasing in such a level. Like, our population has gone up, the number of dogs have gone up, but it really seems like the number of biting incidents has gone up out of proportion to those numbers.
I'm going to ask a question probably a lot of people are thinking or have assumed when they think about this is, does this have something to do with the pandemic? What are the questions around that?
Right. And there's three possible ways that the pandemic might have something to do with this. But honestly, like a personal opinion, and I don't think anybody's researched it, I don't think any of them are really at fault. So during the pandemic, we did not really have the ability to socialize our young dogs. So socialization means getting dogs used to dealing with other dogs, getting used to people.
Right.
During the pandemic, we weren't able to take our puppies and expose them to other young dogs so that they could learn how to be a dog. And that's something that a dog needs to learn by about 5 months, about 20 weeks of age. And if they don't have the opportunity to interact, you know, litter mates, other dogs in the house, next door neighbors, dogs out in the streets, then they basically just make something up and you follow their instincts and react. And those dogs are stuck with that behavioral pattern for the rest of their lives. And it is very, very difficult to teach a dog how to behave differently with other dogs. Now, socialization with people is a completely different thing. During COVID, that didn't happen either because we were locked down. Our dogs were not allowed to go out and meet our neighbors, our friends, people in the park. So they also were unfortunately stuck in a situation of they know how to react with you, their friends, the rest of their family, but they didn't have the ability to learn behavior patterns for other people. That behavior pattern can be modified and can be fairly easily modified. So even if it was a problem during the pandemic, like we're 3 years out now, a lot of that should have been corrected. So, you know, most of the pandemic puppies that I see are scared and nervous. They're not aggressive. They're not going to take action unless you, you know, pin them in a corner and they have no other choice. And that does not seem to be involved in the incidences that we are currently looking at. The other thing that happened during the pandemic is there was a lack of dogs. So we had a number of people decide, you know, for good, for bad, they have a couple of dogs, they can create some more puppies. Maybe there's an economic value in having those dogs and being able to sell them. They weren't breeders. They didn't know what they were doing. They weren't, you know, selecting this male and that female to produce a happy, friendly, jump up, lick you in the face puppy.
Right.
They were just putting two dogs together and producing whatever came out. We also had a lot of people that through, you know, I guess good intentions, went to other countries and rescued dogs, brought them back to Canada. And some of those dogs were, for lack of a better term, street dogs. Aggressiveness is something that a lot of them would need to defend themselves, to acquire food.
Right.
So, you know, potentially did we bring some dogs in that weren't really fit to live in our society? I guess you could say maybe, but most of the rescue dogs that I've seen, they're scared silly. They have huge anxiety issues. They're not aggressive. They need to be coaxed out into society. And once again, you know, the reports that we're getting, that's not the type of dog we are dealing with. So You know, there's some things that circle the topic, but I really have a hard time believing this is a pandemic result.
So where are the dangerous dogs coming from then? When you say, you know, I'm not seeing this behavior in pandemic puppies and I'm not seeing this behavior in dogs adopted from abroad, where are we seeing it?
Yeah, so let's get a couple of definitions. Number one, what is a dangerous dog?
Right.
All dogs can be aggressive. The simple fact that you may be aggressive doesn't make you a dangerous dog. What is supposed to happen is a dog finds itself in a situation and feels the need to lash out to either protect itself, to prove a point, for whatever reason. That dog should either cower, put its ears down, put its tail underneath itself, back away. It will act scared, or it will make eye contact. Its ears will go up, its back will stiffen, its tail rises. And you, if you know dog behavior, will look at those two situations and basically say to yourself, I'm in a little bit of trouble here.
Mm-hmm.
Those dogs will then move forward, lift a lip, open their mouth, and growl. So they bar their teeth and they are now looking at you, and you are quite aware that you are in a little bit of trouble. You may not know why, but it's there. And the dog will then lash out and snap.
Mm.
At that point, the dog will back up and see what it has accomplished. And you will look at yourself and notice that either you have no wounds or you have what I would describe as a minor abrasion. And you will say to yourself, my reflexes were great. I got out of that way. The dog tried to hurt me, but I was good and I avoided it. And that is absolute rubbish. That dog had no intention of hurting you. Its every intention was to make you go backwards and to stop doing what you're doing, self-preservation. That, to me, is not a dangerous dog.
Huh.
That is what we want. Nobody got hurt, and that dog did what it needed to do to make itself feel comfortable, and you have the ability to back away, and nobody has really been that hurt.
Right.
Now, yes, if you have a four-year-old and your four-year-old now has an abrasion on their hand, as a parent, you will have a slightly different view of that situation. But I, as a veterinarian, say that dog's not dangerous. It did exactly what we expected of it. The dangerous dog goes through that entire repertoire in a couple of microseconds. You do not have the ability to stop doing what you're doing. That dog will grab you and apply a full force bite. All teeth will be dug in. It will then slightly loosen its grip. It'll reposition, which means it's now got more of your tissue in its mouth, and it will bite again as hard as it can. It then will shake. The initial bites are to produce, you know, penetrating wounds. The shaking is to tear tissue. And what the shaking really is meant to do is knock the prey off its feet and put it in a more vulnerable position. The dog may let go, it may stop, it may re-engage. That is my definition of a dangerous dog.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
That is terrifying. And if you attach that to 70 pounds worth of muscle, good luck to you doing something about it.
How do we tell the dangerous dogs from the non-dangerous dogs before these incidents happen?
You can't. So, you know, I think most of us in the back of our mind has one of these dangerous dogs attack. We turn around and we look at the owner and say, that owner is probably a knucklehead.
Mm-hmm.
They probably have intentionally kept that dog for whatever reason. But we've got a problem on both ends. We've got a dangerous dog and we've got a member of society that is just not following the rules to protect the rest of society. The difficulty is you can own one of these dogs and not have the faintest idea that you own it until that one set of circumstances comes up that educates you very quickly. So therein lies the problem. That being said, there are potentially lots of warning signs that people might get. If you have a dog that is growling at your two-year-old, you should interpret that as, I need to do something about this. If you find, you know, your cat chasing your grandmother around the apartment, you may want to consider thinking about doing something. If you're walking your dog and it's growling at every person that it passes, maybe you have one of those dogs that eventually is going to do some damage. So, you know, are there overt warning signs that would avoid every bit of this? No, there aren't. But as a responsible dog owner, if you're getting any hints that something may be going on, you need to talk to your veterinarian, run the situation by them, and they will help you.
If it's so difficult to tell, even for the owners, and we're not just talking about individual owners here, you know, we're talking about protecting people from dog attacks on a municipal level, a societal level. What can municipalities do to protect people, and what kinds of things do we do that just don't work?
So the thing that comes to mind that I hear about on a regular basis, the Canadian Veterinary Medical Association is so aware of it that we've actually put a position paper together on it, and that is breed bans, and they don't work.
Some places have banned pit bulls, some have banned other kinds of dogs. Are you saying that there's evidence that that doesn't do anything to the overall number of attacks?
Correct.
Huh.
And that's simply because any dog is capable of this. What they are doing is they're trying to ban dogs that have the tools in their toolkit to do severe damage.
Right.
So, you know, pit bulls were originally designed to fight either other dogs or other animals in a pit. That's where the name comes from. And they have huge muscle power on their heads and their jaws. They're short and stocky, and all their muscle is in their shoulder area. They are a very efficient fighting machine. The difficulty is, you know, the vast majority of pit bulls are happy, friendly, waggy dogs, and their danger to you is they're so solid they can knock you over while they're playing, but they're not out there to, you know, cause big damage.
Right.
If society wants to prevent this sort of problem, what they would really have to do is ban all dogs over, you know, 15, 20 pounds.
You mentioned the 70-pound dog, and I think that's what most people picture being terrified of when we think of dog attacks.
Yeah, and it isn't. So when I started in this business, you know, the better part of 35, 40 years ago, we dealt with a problem called Springer rage. And it was an inherited behavioral issue in Springer Spaniels. Those dogs are like 35 pounds. They caused major damage because they very quickly went from happy to out of control. So, yeah, you know, any dog that's got some muscle power behind it can be involved in one of these biting incidents. The other thing that we fight with is not all of these incidents are the same. So the episode in Toronto, just a dog in an off-leash park that shouldn't have been off-leash, shouldn't have been in the park, and a young child, and the child gets mauled. Well, did the dog consider that child to be a threat and attacked it? Did that dog consider the child to be prey? Thought it was a squirrel and went after it for that reason. And those are very, you know, two very, very, very different situations that you're trying to fix with a breed ban or with legislation. We've got the situation in Edmonton with two very, very large dogs known to the young child. I think we have a father saying, never expected this. The child has known these dogs. We don't know what happened because it happened behind closed doors. But we do know that when you get multiple dogs together, just like when you get large numbers of people together, you can develop a mob mentality. So like multiple dogs off leash that know each other, that is not a good and continuously safe environment for somebody to be in. You don't know what's going to happen. And there does seem to be in some dogs a little switch inside their brain that goes from I'm normal, happy, friendly, carrying on the behaviors I've always carried on, that then switches over to, I am now aggressive and I'm now in fighting mode. And that switch tends to get flicked much more often when we are playing, engaging, wrestling with our dogs and when there are two dogs instead of one dog. There are some breeds of dogs that we are suspicious have that switch either in their system or much closer to the surface of the system, and we don't know which it is. More than likely, all dogs have the switch because we're pretty sure all people do. If pushed hard enough, most of us will, you know, turn into a different person than who we normally are. And some of that is where, once again, the breed ban stuff has come from. Pit bulls are much more apt to go from happy, friendly into aggressive, harmful machines. Maybe they are and maybe they aren't, but the take-home message on that one, you know, from my point as a veterinarian, there is no way in the world that a couple of either terrier-type dogs or bull-type dogs should ever be off-leash in a park together. I think that's a higher risk situation than, let's say, two black labs running around. Scientifically, I don't think that's been proven, but most veterinarians, I suspect, would agree with that statement.
So we've talked about the breeds, we've talked about the sizes, and I might come back to that. But first, tell me the other things that municipalities do that don't work, and then please tell us what might.
Number one, let's take the quote-unquote dangerous dog legislation, and they're usually done at a provincial level. Why don't we harmonize them? Like, why do we need Ontario to have a different law than Alberta and a different law from British Columbia? So why don't we harmonize them and get a harmonized definition of exactly what a dangerous dog is? And then what usually happens is those laws have to be enforced on the municipal level, so city, county. Why don't we harmonize that stuff too so that everybody across the country knows the rules of the road? They have to be on a leash. Somebody has to be on the other end of the leash. The leash can only be X amount of length. There are only certain locations where the dogs are allowed to be off leash. Let's get it consistent. And then let's figure out who it is that is actually going to enforce this. Because in some areas, it is what I refer to as bylaw or animal control, a city employee. In some situations, it is the humane societies. It is not the police. They have better things to do than to look after this. But let's get some generalized training across the country done so that we've got some consistency. And then once we're in that situation, let's put enough manpower on the job to do this properly, not only from the enforcement point, but also from the follow-up and are people actually doing what they're supposed to be doing. So from my point of view, it does no good to put a dog on, let's say, a muzzle order. For whatever reason, that dog has committed a serious enough offense that the city of Ottawa has decided it's to be muzzled all time it's outside, not in the owner's house. We need to put something in place so that we can actually tell that the people are doing it. Which, you know, honestly, it's a manpower issue and you can't watch people all the time. And when I go through these biting incidences, and I think you've already noticed it, a lot of these dogs have already come in contact with enforcement agencies.
Yeah.
Some of them are on muzzle orders, but they're not muzzled. There's no piece of legislation that's going to be perfect. You need buy-in from the person that owns the dangerous dog. And sometimes we just don't get that buy-in.
Let me ask you something, though, as somebody who doesn't own a dog, doesn't hate dogs, can take or leave them, has known some nice dogs, has known some mean dogs. Should we destroy the dog after the first incident? You already mentioned it. This is something that we've seen in a couple of these brutal attacks. I don't want to be insensitive to the animal or to the owner, but I mean, to me, it seems like kind of a no-brainer.
Right. So there's three different pieces of this puzzle. There is the rights of the person that owns the dog. And those rights have to be, unfortunately, respected in our society. There's the rights of society to live in a safe environment. And then there is the dog itself. And the dog has no rights whatsoever. Under the law, they are a piece of chattel. They are treated like your automobile. But because of the special place that dogs have in our society, as a society, we look at that animal that, you know, can't speak for itself, and we do our best to give it a voice so that we don't do something brutally wrong. Now, the problem is that not all situations are created equal. So let me give you an example. Somebody breaks into your house. Your dog tears a chunk out of their arm and they leave your house. They weren't supposed to be there in the first place. I think a large number of society would say that dog is supposed to be congratulated, not destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
But it has bitten, it has caused a severe damage. Under the definition, it is a dangerous dog. Doesn't matter, it was provoked, it did something it wasn't supposed to do.
Hmm.
Should that dog be destroyed? On a personal level, I've always had the idea of two things. We have dogs because they give us pleasure. And we're around dogs because we enjoy it. Not all dogs are designed to live in our society. And the ones that aren't, I really don't think that as a society, we need to bend over backwards to try to make those dogs fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And personally, if my dog did any of the things that I saw through the news, that dog would be gone and it would be gone very, very quickly. And I would have no hesitation doing that. The difficulty is when you're writing legislation, you got to be really, really careful that, you know, putting out broad statements, every dog that's ever bitten and has caused severe damage should be destroyed immediately. It just doesn't fit all the situations.
Hmm.
These have to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. I think the default position should be, you know, we need to prove that that dog can be rehabilitated and is safe to be around. It shouldn't be the opposite. And most importantly, a veterinarian should be involved in these decisions. We know this subject better than your average bylaw officer or police officer or judge. It's one of the places where our profession can help society. And no, if people are sitting back saying, oh, the veterinarian's always going to be on the side of the dog, they will do absolutely everything they can to preserve that life. That's not the way it is.
Getting all our governments to act in accordance with one another on a single issue is difficult to say the least. Finding resources to enforce bylaws, also difficult. So I hate that it brings me to personal responsibility, but I'll ask you this as somebody who understands dogs. What should people know to do in the event of an aggressive dog, or they're in a park with their child and you see a dog running towards your kid? All the stuff that I know when people see these stories we've been talking about runs through their head.
Yeah, and I wish I had a really, really good answer for you, and unfortunately, I don't. So let me give you two different situations. Situation number one is you've spotted a dog, it's a fair way away, and your brain has said, this is just looking a little sketchy, what do I do? The answer to that is turn around and get out of the situation. The answer to that question is not make yourself big, make noise, move towards the animal, act aggressively. This is not a piece of wildlife that you can scare away. If this dog means business and you decide to act aggressively, you're going to trigger it. You're going to make it worse. You're not going to make it better.
Mm-hmm.
If it's fairly obvious that the dog is in a space that you need to cross, you might want to decide not to cross the space, find some other way of getting to where you want to get to. If the dog is on a leash, don't, you know, try to move around that person a foot further away from where the dog can reach. Common sense, get away. The difficulty is if that dog means business, we just don't have a whole lot of things that we can do to fix that situation. You know, the average 40-pound muscular dog, you're not going to outrun it. And in actual fact, running away from it is probably just going to trigger a chase response in the dog and make things worse. You're not going to be able to stop it from biting you. Its reflexes are much faster than you are. And most of us are not walking around, you know, the streets of Toronto or Ottawa with a can of bear spray in our pocket, which, you know, is probably the best solution to a lot of this.
Right.
You know, moving, dropping, acting dead. Some people have recommended that when you're dealing with wildlife, it puts you in an awful vulnerable situation.
Yeah.
And, you know, it may quiet the dog if it considers you to be a threat. But if that dog, for some reason, has just decided that you are something to be taken out of that park, it's not going to help you. So I don't have any brilliant suggestions. Same idea, you're there and you're witnessing a dog attack. What do you do? Well, the ability to get a dog's jaw open when it's clamped on somebody is minimal. And if you do, your fingers are not where you want them to be. Your ability to inflict enough pain on that dog to make it give up on its current target and try something else. Most of these dogs, when this is happening, they are in a rage. And like people in you know, excited situations, you just don't feel a whole lot of pain.
Right.
So if you have a bucket of water you can dump on, maybe that'll do something, but that's just not the situations we find ourselves in. So, you know, the best idea is if it's happening, get somewhere where the dog can't get to you. That's, you know, not anywhere close to a good answer.
The more I speak to you, the more I'm coming to the conclusion that this is on heavy enforcement if we're going to get a handle on this.
I think so. And it's also, it goes the other way. You know, some of this is also on responsible pet ownership. You know, owning a dog is a privilege. If you're going to have a privilege, these are the rules. If it's outside, it has to be on a leash. Yes, maybe the dog would be having more fun if it wasn't, but that's not the way it works. Yes, my dog is completely friendly. It's never going to hurt anybody. So I can let it off its leash. Nothing is ever going to happen. But that's not the situation. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I also listen to people that, I don't know, they see things that horrify me that don't seem to bother them. Yeah, how's the dog? Any problems? No, everything is fine and dandy. Anything you need to tell me about? Oh, no, he was out in the backyard. He killed a squirrel a couple of days ago and ate it. But, you know, he didn't get any diarrhea, so I think that's fine. My brain goes, it did what? There's no rules or legislation that says if a dog kills a cat, we should be doing something. If it kills a piece of wildlife, we should be doing something. But to me, that is a flag. I wouldn't just blow that off. Pay attention.
Tim, thanks for all of this. I really appreciate the conversation, and I feel like I understand this in a little more depth now.
Excellent. I hope it's been helpful.
That was Dr. Tim Arthur. And that was The Big Story. For more from us, you can head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can also give us some feedback. I am sure there are some dog owners out there who have something to say about this episode, one way or the other. We would love to hear it. The way to do that is via email, hello@thebigstorypodcast.ca, or by calling us and leaving a voicemail. You can do that at 416-935-5935. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.